The following program is paid for by CHI Mercy Health Mercy Medical Center. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Each weekday, News Radio 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now, Talking Health, presented by CHI Mercy Health. Now, here's Talking Health with Lisa Platt on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
And playing the part of Lisa Platt today. Hi there again, I'm Kyle Bailey. With everything going on in the world, especially in healthcare in the past couple of weeks, Lisa Platt and some of the folks from Mercy and other organizations that you would normally hear on here talking with Lisa about what they do in the community are all busy doing things related to the COVID-19 situation. And so Lisa not in today. And so I am going to do the program today, but we've got a number of folks coming in, including Dr. Bob Dannenhofer, who is still working hard to get his name on the bill of the staff of the station, practically, from making so many appearances here. And also we're gonna have Kristen Rutledge and Vanessa Becker, both from the Douglas Public Health Network. Well, Dr. Bob, first of all, thanks for coming in this afternoon.
Well, thank you for having me.
So explain, let's start out and kind of frame it, because we're going to spend this hour going in-depth on COVID-19 and the local response. You've been on several times in the last couple of weeks on different segments we've done. But kind of reframe it for people, because it's certainly the only topic of discussion out there by just about anyone for various reasons. What is COVID-19? First of all.
So COVID-19 is the name of the syndrome that is caused by the coronavirus. So coronaviruses have existed for many, many years. Coronaviruses are viruses that animals carry sometimes and people carry sometimes. And we think they move between animals and people. So for many years, there have been four kinds of coronaviruses that have circulated in the world. These coronaviruses don't cause a lot of troubles and cause mostly an upper respiratory infection, runny nose, and rarely cause anything more serious. So for many years, we had these four coronaviruses, and they were sort of interesting, but not that interesting. In 2002 and 2003, there was an outbreak of severe respiratory distress, which started in China, and then spread to other places in the world. That was called SARS, and SARS was caused by a coronavirus. That caused a very severe pneumonia, killing almost 10% of the people who had it. Almost everybody who had it was very sick. And within the space of a year or so, we were able to eradicate that because it was so easy to pick up the sick people. Now, we think these viruses typically start in bats. Bats have an amazing immune system where they can tolerate viruses without getting sick. And then because bats tend to congregate, they share these viruses with each other. And then because they tend to leave droppings all over the place, they do spread to other animals. So SARS was thought to spread from bats to civet cats, which are like kind of raccoon, and then to people. And then once it got in people, it circulated. It was very serious but not very contagious. But it was a real worry because it was a sense that coronaviruses could be a real danger. Then in the 2010s, there was another coronavirus. This one we think started in bats and went to camels and then to people. This was called MERS, which was very serious but not particularly contagious. And there are still occasional cases of this in the Middle East, but you don't see very much of it around. Things were then well until the fall or winter of 2019, when they started noticing a kind of unusual pneumonia developing in people in China. And it was found by about the turn of the year that this was caused also by a coronavirus. This coronavirus, we think, started in bats also and probably went to things called pangolins, which are spiny anteaters. Adorably cute if you looked them up on Wikipedia. And thought then to spread to people. And then it spread widely in China in January. By February, it spread to the rest of the world, and now in March, it's really taken off.
So during the other two, during MERS and SARS, was the reaction from public health, government agencies, all of that, was it a lot different than what we're seeing right now with all the things like what we've experienced today with the governor's new order?
So it was nothing like that, because these diseases were fairly well controlled in certain areas. There are places in China, and then only really one place in North America, in Toronto, where this spread. It was so serious, and we didn't think there were any symptomatic or pre-symptomatic transmission. So you could find these really sick people, find the people they were around, and take care of them. There were only about 1,000 cases ever. So only about 10,000 cases ever. So there were not really a lot of cases. And so you really could donate the resource to get that done. There were about 800 deaths. This one is different, and this one is so much harder. It is much more contagious than SARS. So SARS was not particularly contagious. This one is really quite contagious. You know, we've seen places where the case rates double every 3 days. This is really contagious. And the other one is, this is not particularly serious. And you think, well, that would be a good thing. But by not being particularly serious, and by having some people who are asymptomatic and presymptomatic, they don't even know they're sick, and they can bring it around and share it with other people. And that's why, if you were going to create sort of a stealthy superbug, this would be it.
So we talked initially about the impacts mainly being on older people and those with immune systems that were not the norm, maybe had other issues. Is that still showing out, or it seems like I've heard more about younger people having this as well?
Yeah, so the story on this is that the death rate is so much higher in seniors than others. We think everybody can get it, and everybody can get sick, but we think younger people are much more likely to recover. So in a recent study in kids in China, they got it just like you'd expect them to, but they either had a minor illness. At worst, they needed to be in the hospital, but there were no deaths. As you start to get to be in your 20s to 50s, people get sick with this, and some people get hospitalized, and some people die. So it's still, still in that age group, still twice as deadly as the seasonal flu. But once you start getting in the 60-year-old age group, 5% mortality. Once you get 80 and above, 15% mortality. Now, that is just enormous high death rate in seniors.
And we've seen that borne out in the statistics from the Oregon Health Authority regarding the veterans home in Lebanon, where there have been several cases.
What a tragedy. So here, you know, our veterans who served our country, and now in their final years, they're in the veterans home and have got this disease. And so many of the deaths are there. When we look in Italy also, most of the deaths are in people over 60.
Well, in Italy, I understand as well, it's one of the places I would like to go to at some point, probably not soon. Italy's population trends a lot older in general than some other countries as well.
Right. So Italy has an older population, as does Douglas County. So when you look at the older population there, it's about 20% over age 65, which is just where we are in Douglas County. So we are in, we have a lot of older people, and so this could really be hard here.
You know, as we see the data coming in from around the country, and I think you could just about stare at media sources 24/7 and keep getting updates, because this is, keeps moving along. One of the things I heard earlier this morning was in an area in Massachusetts, because you talk about it being so easy to spread, that there was a, I want to say convention, I don't think that was quite right, but some large meeting, just typical meeting of people in a certain business and industry, whatever, and they were meeting for 2 or 3 days, and towards the end, somebody wasn't feeling as well, et cetera. They got it, and then a whole bunch of other people ended up with it who were all in that same meeting as well, and that probably speaks to what you said about they didn't know they even had it yet. Other people thought they were fine, and by the time they got it, it was already starting to affect some of these other folks.
So there are some very extraordinary stories from this virus. So, for example, the Diamond Princess, which is a cruise ship, they started with one case in January, and by then in February they had 700. So it's a big spread. There's another story of a lawyer in upstate New York who had this and felt well, continued on his daily activities, and infected 51 people. So there do appear to be in this disease some super spreaders, that is, people who have a lot of virus but who aren't particularly sick, and so they go about their duties. So other diseases, like smallpox, is really quite contagious, but by the time you're really contagious with smallpox, you're really sick and you're covered with these blisters, so it's not like people are going to miss who you are. With this disease, if you're relatively well, you could spread this to a lot of people. And that's why we worry about this. So that's why this is sort of a super bug, not because it's that deadly. If it was more deadly, it would actually be a little easier to control because you'd know who the people were. It's because there are so many asymptomatic and mildly symptomatic people, it's really hard to pick out.
Now, you mentioned, and I want to just make sure I've got this framed correctly, among seniors, what was the percentage that if they got it, it could be fatal?
Yeah, 5% in the 60s and 15% in the 80s.
Wow.
That's a high rate. So, you know, when you consider, for example, seasonal flu, it's 1 or 2% above 80. It's not 15.
And for people in their 80s, so many of them are at various stages of care. They may just be in a retirement home doing just fine mentally and physically. They might be in assisted living or a memory care facility possibly as well. But any of those facilities are ones where they would come in contact with many people over the course of the day because that's one of the things they do is socialize because that's available.
So we think there are two issues in senior homes. One is we want seniors to congregate so that they can maintain their mental sharpness and friendships and whatever. The other issue with those homes is they're frequently staffed by relatively young people. So the 20, 22-year-old person who's working there and goes out at night to the bar and then works the next day, they may have exposures and they may not be particularly ill, and they're the ones that can then spread it to the seniors. So the seniors are at great risk. So really the concern for seniors who are living at home is to stay home, really be careful, stay healthy. And for seniors who are in nursing homes, for them to use meticulous infection control.
Over the weekend, I spent a lot of time here, but a couple of times when I was able to get out of the office, one was going out into the Umpqua area and then over to Oakland. It was a beautiful day for a ride. It was 70 degrees and just enjoyed driving my car and looking around the countryside as we're getting into spring now. But I noticed in different places, I watched groups of people. The ones I happened to see, I actually thought were probably kind of appropriately spaced out, if you will. And did anybody even hear of social distancing a month ago? I mean, this is such a quick phrase change. But the people that I saw seemed to be doing okay. It looks like, you know, families that are normally together anyway and people playing soccer and things like that. But then, as folks heard in the past hour on Lars, you know, in the North Coast area, Tillamook, Seaside, et cetera, they got hit like a typical wave of tourists on a sunny day when there haven't been any sunny days for a long time. And that was very concerning and to a lot of those folks.
So social distancing, we think, is going to be the key to getting this under control. So imagine I could spread it to the people who are within 6 feet of me. And the more people you come in contact with in 6 feet, the better it is. So also this weekend was a beautiful, beautiful weekend. And so I was very cautious of my social contacts. So I've been cautious of this for years. I think my highest was 1,100 a few years ago when we traveled and we flew and we went to an amusement park and then to Comic-Con. I thought I had 1,100 social contacts in that day. Yesterday, I was actually getting down to one, which is my wife, because I tried really hard. So if somebody was carrying it back in the time that 1,100 contacts versus yesterday where I had one contact, I reduced my risk by more than 99%. So we're not asking people to be total hermits and live on top of a mountain, but really to be strong about decreasing your social distancing. So again, the analogy I used on the Facebook Live was, imagine this germ was that I have a black magic marker and I could go ahead and spray you with that or mark you with that magic marker. And once you got marked, you got a whole handful of black magic markers. And then you marked everybody that you came in contact with and it went on and on. You could imagine it's something like a Blazers game. By the end of the Blazers game, everyone would have a mark or two on their forehead. And so the lots of spread at that point. Whereas what I've done today, I've had a lot of meetings, I've done a lot of work today, but I don't think I've had any people that I've marked because as you could see, we're now 6 feet apart. We're doing it with only me in the studio so that we're gonna have other people who are 6 feet apart. And it's not easy to do. You know, the people wanna come up and give me a hug, the people wanna shake hands, and I just have to back off. because I know that I don't want to get infected. I have got a lot of work to do. And I certainly, if I'm a carrier, I don't want to infect anybody else. So social distancing is really the key. Travel bans can slow things down a little bit, but that's not going to be sufficient. There's no vaccine. There are no medications for this. So we're really going to have to work on social distancing.
Going to take a break when we come back, and we'll add somebody else in a different part of the room. Kristen Rutledge coming in a moment. The interview podcast after, coming up later at 541radio.com. Talking Health, Kyle Bailey in for Lisa Plath this afternoon. News Radio 1240, KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240, KQEN.
Afternoon, and hi there. No, I'm not Lisa Platt. You may have noticed. Kyle Bailey and Lisa Platt busy working at things with the Mercy Foundation and Mercy Medical Center. So bringing in folks today to talk about COVID-19, Dr. Bob Dannenhofer with us throughout the program, but also adding in Kristen Rutledge, Douglas Public Health Program Manager. Thanks for coming over.
Thanks for having me.
So I know you have been very busy with a lot of areas. Talk about some of the things you've been working on in the past couple of weeks.
So the biggest one has been working on personal protective equipment for our healthcare workers and fire and EMS personnel.
So explain, for people that aren't quite sure exactly what that means, what are these PPEs?
Yeah, so PPE is the equipment that they're going to be wearing if they come into contact with someone who has a suspected or confirmed COVID-19 infection. And that includes things like face masks, N95s, gowns, gloves, and goggles.
Now, normally you think about people using those, and I would presume in typical times they're available, but not something that they are using very much. And I understand that they're all taking more precautions.
Correct.
And needing to essentially go through more of them?
Mm-hmm, that's what they're doing. So if somebody comes in with any sort of symptoms like the cough and a fever, they're going to be using more personal protective equipment than they would normally be using. So they'll be using the N95, they're going to be using the goggles, and they'll be using gowns. Whereas before they might be using a mask, they'll be masking the patient, but they're masking more patients that are coming in with any of these symptoms just to be on the safe side. So they're going through a lot more than they used to. And there's also a shortage in the country and around the world.
And because many other places are dealing
Absolutely.
With the same situation.
Mm-hmm.
We had a story on last week from the local fire departments about some of their staff having to get very creative and find different things and sort of repurpose them. Mm-hmm. And even some things that look rather odd and a bit like they belong in science fiction just to stay safe.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's not a lot coming in. And so we're just trying to use what we can and help our frontline workers really get the protection that they need.
So normally are these things that the individual, like the fire districts, the hospital, places like that, they all are normally just getting on their own, right?
Yeah, they're getting on their own, or they don't get them at all. So some rural fire districts don't have these things regularly because they don't usually use them. So now they're needing to use equipment that they haven't used before regularly. So this is just trying to get the information out for them, trying to understand what they need and get the requests into them from the state so that they can stay safe.
So Bob, for these PPEs, for being a doctor yourself, explain how important that really is.
Well, that's important to protect our staff. So if our staff gets sick and they can't work, then they can't work, and it's not like these are jobs that anybody can just pick up in a moment. So it's really important to protect our staff so that they don't get sick.
Now, this is led, if I'm understanding correctly, from not today, but backing up, just some of the changes in terms of some medical offices not staying in full operation or pulling back a bit just to make some of these more available.
So what we're seeing now is a bad situation. So we're using a lot more PPE because we're worried about people getting this. And the supply chain for PPE is way down. So much of this is made in China. China is not exporting this stuff and keeping it for their own use. And many of the hospitals have gone to disposable stuff. So in the past, where you might have been able to launder gowns and use them again, most have gone to disposable. So you're using more and getting less, and that's why we have this pinch.
So, Kristen, what about, and I know somebody asked me about this last week, what about people that are, for instance, trying to, you know, sell masks, things like that? Talk about maybe the differences in what's required if you're a healthcare worker or, you know, EMT, et cetera, versus what somebody might just want to have if they thought that, you know, to keep themselves safer.
Mm-hmm. So for our healthcare workers and first line responders, we're really wanting them to still be using the N95s, wanting them to use the gowns. We're trying to save all of those, all of that equipment for them. For people that just want a mask, we actually are working with Oregon Serographics to be putting that response together for homemade masks. They have a process. They're going to be in place. They're going to be using one set of patterns and then the same materials, and then they'll be putting that together and then giving those masks to us, and we can distribute them to the clinics. I know there's also another group, I believe, that's going through and doing these masks for people in the community that want them. But as far as the CDC doesn't currently recommend that the general public uses face masks, they ask that they wash their hands, social distancing, things like that. But if they do want them, they are available.
So, Bob, for the average person, is sometimes this is a little bit of a placebo kind of situation?
So sometimes people want to wear masks. They think that's going to make them more safe. The masks are really important for the person who is sick. So if you're sick and coughing, it's really important that the person wears a mask because the droplets that come in your mouth are relatively big, relatively high velocity when they leave your mouth, and that's why the mask on the patient is really quite important. That mask does not need to be a very relatively high-level mask. A cloth mask, actually, we think will work fine. Certainly any of the manufactured masks should work just fine. Now, for the provider who's getting exposed to many people during the day, and especially if they're exposed to fine aerosol droplets, they really need to get protected with a high-level mask. The issue about people wearing masks in public is when you wear a mask in public, if you've ever done it, you have a tendency to touch your face a lot. I mean, for those of us, for people who have not worn a mask, the first time you wear a mask, it's just an unusual feeling. So people have a tendency to touch their face in their mask.
Then touch the produce they're looking
and
at.
That's, and that's, yeah, or touch the doorknob or whatever. And we think that may be defeating the purpose. So we are saying that it's generally not recommended. I'm certainly going to stop anybody who does it. I lived for a while in Japan, and it was a big fashion thing. And even at a time when there's no disease going around, people wore masks. So I'm not going to tell people to stop, but any sense that this mask is going to prevent the receiver from getting the disease is probably not true. And because of the number of times you touch your face, it may actually make it worse. So we're not supporting that, but we do clearly want people who are sick to stay at home. But if you have to go out to go to the doctor, if you have to go out for medical treatment, to put a mask on.
So, Kristen, what are some of the other things you're working on?
Another thing is, so we're working with Mercy Foundation for a PPE drop-off donation. So if people have things at home, any old masks, gloves, so we want them to be unopened and unused, but they can drop those off over at Mercy Foundation. Their number is 541-677-4818. They can give them a call, drop those things off, and we can get them to first responders in the hospitals.
Would people typically have these around very often?
If they were caring for a loved one in their home, or if they were using masks for construction or things like that.
And, well, then that brings in a point from, have you seen people from these other industries donated them?
Or they are starting to, yes. Yeah, so we're getting some from dentist offices, veterinary offices, and some construction.
Wow. So explain to people kind of what your role is in Douglas Public Health in general.
So in general, I'm a program manager. I manage most of our educational programs. and do educational events for the public.
And how long have you been in that role?
About 3 years now.
So this has probably got to be unlike anything you've ever experienced.
It definitely is. Yes, this is very new to me. I've worked in the medical facility for quite a while before this, but not like this.
What has it been like to be in your position and suddenly having all this sort of land in part of your lap, if you will?
Well, we do have a great team at DPHN. We work really, really well together. I think we're doing a great job of trying to keep everybody informed of what's going on, trying to be innovative with how we're responding, and just keeping our team together. We're doing a great job of keeping our spirits up.
Now, are you seeing, we've had one case positive in Douglas County. I imagine you guys field calls from people, especially right now.
Yeah, we're fielding a lot of calls. We're still getting a lot of calls, even with the hotline. We're still getting calls all day long about questions that people have.
Wow. And do you feel most people are looking at this pretty rationally, or is there a little bit of fear creeping in there?
I think there's a lot of fear creeping in. You know, this is something that none of us have ever been through before, especially people that are younger. This is not something that they've ever seen, and I don't think that they're really prepared for.
Now, Bob, you, as a pediatrician for a long time, you talked about SARS and MERS. I mean, you were a doctor then. Talk about just the differences.
So SARS and MERS never came to Oregon, and so we never had a case of that. Now, we do see flu every year. And certainly I was around during 2009 when we had the early and unusual flu season that we called swine flu at the time. And that was a big worry because we had a lot of hospitalizations, we had a lot of sick staff, and we had some deaths. So that was a deal. But to put that in perspective, that disease doubled every 3 weeks. This disease doubles every 3 days. And so anybody who remembers their algebra, something that doubles every 3 days in a month is going to be totally out of control, where something that doubles every 3 weeks in a month is going to be a little more than three times. So the doubling on this one is so very worrisome. And when we look all around the world, be it almost every country, in the first 3 weeks of the disease, they have this very rapid increase in the disease. And so we in Oregon are just at the beginning of that curve.
And in fact, over the weekend, I was working on one of the many news stories we've put up at 541radio.com, and there was some data in there, and I was looking at one of the national reports at that point, and they said, 30,000, and I'm like, wait a second, it was 10,000, and that's one of the days you came in, it had gone to 10,000 last week, and then by yesterday, we're at 30, and of course, it's well past that now.
Yes, so that's the big concern. So the cases in the U.S. doubled, just the cases in the world outside of China doubled just between our briefing on Friday and our briefing this morning. And so that rate of rise is really very, very worrisome. The problem with this virus is that, the death rate of an overall death rate of between 1 and 4% doesn't seem that great. But our hospital system is not set up to take this huge influx of patients. So one of the phrases you may have heard along with social distancing is flattening the curve. And what this means is that we'll still get a lot of cases, but not all at once. And so that's really our goal, is avoid getting all the cases at once, which will overwhelm the system. Right now, it's eerily quiet here in Douglas County. We've done 57 tests, 56 are negative. And one is positive. Now, we did a bunch of testing last week. We still do not have those results back yet. But that'll tell us again. But it's kind of eerily quiet in Douglas County and surrounding areas. It's really hopping up in Portland, Linn County, Marion County, and in Deschutes County. They're having a lot of cases and a lot of spread. But still, maybe the quiet before the storm down here.
And Kristen, if people want to find out more, I know you've got a lot of things on your website, on the mm-hmm. county site. How do they access that?
Yeah, they can go to our website, Douglas Public Health Network. And then they can also go to our Facebook page at Douglas Public Health Network. We do now have a Twitter and a YouTube page. If they want to find out more about how to donate, new and unopened gloves, masks, and gowns, they can reach Mercy Foundation at 541-677-4818. And then Oregon Serographics is the one that is helping set up the homemade mask collection, and their phone number is 541-672-6296.
All right, Kristen Rutledge, thanks for coming
in. Thank you much.
We're going to continue with more and add in Vanessa Becker in just a moment to talk about these drive-through clinics recently and more. In Felisa Platt, it's Talking Health, 437 at News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Afternoon, 440, Talking Health. Kyle Bailey in for Lisa Platt today, and Vanessa Becker, Public Information Officer for Douglas Public Health Network, along with Dr. Bob Dannenhofer in this segment. Vanessa, talk about these drive-through clinics that have been going on recently.
Yes, good afternoon, Kyle. So we're really excited as you can be in a pandemic like this, to be able to say that we're the first in the state to have a drive-through COVID-19 testing clinic. We ran our first pilot last Tuesday. We had 17 patients that were referred by their provider to come through the clinic, and it went so well that we had another clinic on Friday, the 20th, and we had another 35. We've been getting a lot of questions about the results from those, and we don't have those yet, and we'll talk a little bit about the process of that, and Dr. Dannenhofer can speak to that some. But we're also offering a third clinic tomorrow at the fairgrounds, and again, it has to be an order from your physician, so you have to see your physician and get that order, and as Dr. Dannenhofer says, the process really is we're sort of like phlebotomists, where we collect the specimen, do the nasal swab, and we do that for free, no cost. And then we ship your specimens off to Quest, which is out of state, and it looks like it's about a week to get results from that. But really, that's the process that Douglas Public Health Network is doing, is collecting the specimen and also conserving personal protective equipment, as many, so we were able to get several people to go through with just one face shield and, of course, different gloves. But yeah, it's been a really win because we've been able to get more people tested as well as preserve that precious PPE.
And I understand a lot of other public health entities around the state and even beyond have looked at this to go, okay, wait a second, what are you doing and how does this work?
Yeah, we fielded several calls. I know Dr. Dannenhofer has as well, and all of us at DPHN. People wondering how did we get this working? And I think a lot of it is just around the ingenuity and innovation and collaboration that we have in this community, which is unusual in other communities around the state, and I would also say nationwide.
And Dr. Bob, this goes back to, and I remember the first time you brought up this idea 3 years ago or so of doing this for a flu clinic, but you made it clear that you had a bigger idea in mind.
Right, so I almost never do anything with a single purpose. So the double purpose at that time was to, the first was to get people immunized against the flu, which is very important. But the second one was to practice what we would do if something like this happened. Either we needed to do mass testing, we needed to do mass dispensing, such as after nuclear attack, or if we needed to give lots of vaccines. So the hope is that we'll have a COVID vaccine at some point. And when we do, a lot of people are going to want the vaccine really quickly. And our drive-through flu clinic showed us that we give a lot of vaccines in a very short period of time, so much faster than going to your doctor, so much faster than going to Rite Aid. We think we could, if properly scaled up, could give thousands of vaccines in a single day.
Well, and looking at the pictures from the first time you did it and the second time as well, it's interesting because you and whoever the other providers are that are doing it, you really look like you're out of a science fiction film.
So in this collection thing, we do look like we're out of science fiction film. but we're not. What we're doing is we're using these portable respirators, which are extremely efficient in getting rid of particles. So N95 masks means that it gets rid of 95%. These are N99.7s, which means that it gets rid of 99.7% of the particles. And so the people who are collecting this are very safe. Also, because it's not touching your face, people can actually see me when I'm doing it. And people are a little scared when I take this big Q-tip and shove it up their nose. So it's nice for them to be able to see my face. And the third is you only have to use one of these disposable things during the entire clinic. And so we can preserve our PPE. These respirators are not typically used in hospitals, so we're not using any of their equipment. And we're able to do this with great safety for the collectors, as well as hopefully a little bit more reassuring for the patients.
So, Vanessa, to put all this together, you've been doing it at the fairgrounds. What was kind of involved? I mean, you had to ask a lot of people a lot of favors, essentially, in a short period of time.
Yes, I think one of the biggest barriers that we've seen nationwide around testing is just being gathering the testing materials, so both the swabs and the medium that the swab goes into as it gets sent to the lab. And I think one of the really fabulous thing that happened locally is that we, as a healthcare community, all the partners came together and looked at what supplies do we have locally instead of trying to wait for other sort of quote unquote kits to come. And so we were able to gather those and make this clinic happen. And I want to say, and of course I wasn't with Douglas Public Health Network at this time, but I think at the beginning, the very first of the three flu clinics that were run, the first one took several weeks to put together. This really took just a couple of days because Public Health had already put that and run those processes together as far as, you know, walkie-talkies and security and parking and how do we run people through the process? What kind of timing would it take? Is it going to take 20 minutes per swab or is it going to take 5 minutes? So a lot of those things were already worked through the logistics, and I think that also allowed not only the ability to look for local supplies for testing, but also looking for our just the logistics and the supplies, other supplies that we needed.
And as we've emphasized along the way, these are sort of pre-qualified, if you will, people, because what we wanted to say at the outset, the first time we mentioned these, is don't just show up. You've got to have been asked to be there by your doctor going through all the steps.
Right. So the patients that we've seen so far have to be referred by their physician. And typically that means that they've had some kind of symptomology around COVID-19. Dr. Danhofer can speak to this a little bit more. But so even though we've been able to be, you know, pretty practice a lot of ingenuity to gather the local testing supplies, they're still limited. So we're really trying to test people who have symptoms already, who are at high risk. And that has to go through your healthcare provider.
So, Dr. Bob, what are some of those symptomatic areas that would lend themselves towards somebody being qualified to be tested?
So what we're trying to do is we're trying to get people who have the highest risk of being positive. Now, this test doesn't change what your care would be because, again, it's a week later. But it really helps us to know whether the virus has arrived in Douglas County. It's been 30 days since our last case, and this lull that I've been talking about could be because we're missing cases, or could be that the virus has not yet arrived. So these 52 cases or 52 patients that we swabbed last week have the highest likelihood of being positive. They've had fever and cough for more than 2 days and no other good explanation for their fever. So, you know, they're at high risk, and this will help us to know. So of the 52, if none are positive, it means the virus hasn't arrived yet, which would be the greatest news, which would suggest that we have a few more weeks to prepare until it gets here. If all 52 are positive, it means that it's going to be here much quicker.
So, Vanessa, to get all of these people on board, I mean, you've worked with a lot of different organizations in the community, and you worked with people in a lot of other places. How different is it here in terms of people's willingness to sort of let their turf down and work together?
I think there's a lot of similarities, certainly, in my experience working in 2015 through our shooting at UCC, where we really saw daily, we saw resilience locally in individuals and organizations and our groups and our families. And I think this is another instance that our community is coming together and saying this is important. We need to get, whether it be testing or testing supplies or treatment or care, that we're really showing that level of resilience that we're known for.
Going to take a break. And Vanessa, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
We're going to talk to Bob a little bit more with Dr. Bob Dannenhofer, wrap things up and talk about some things people can get participating in here when we return on Talking Health 449 and News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is a special edition of Talking Health. Lisa Platt away dealing with the Mercy Foundation of Mercy Medical and all the things going on that they're involved in with COVID-19. Dr. Bob Dannenhofer with us throughout the program today. Vanessa Becker, Public Information Officer from Douglas Public Health in our last segment. Kristen Rutledge, Douglas Public Health Program Manager before that. We're going to wrap up here in our final about 7 minutes or so with Dr. Bob, talking about a couple things in particular. This COVID-19 hotline, explain that for folks if they're not familiar with it.
So we know that people have lots of questions about COVID, either general questions about COVID or questions about their health. And we want to be sure that people get the best and most up-to-date information about what they should do. So we, with the help of many others, we put together this hotline, and it consists of call screeners who have general information about COVID, similar to what you get on 211. But then we also have nurses and doctors who can take phone calls and, using our strategy, triage those calls. Most people are just worried, and they just need to stay home. Some people are sick and need to go to the emergency room, and then we can be sure if they're sick and they go to the emergency room that everybody's wearing the proper protective gear when they get there. But the good news is that most people are not particularly sick. They're just worried and scared.
So talk about the people that you're pulling in to take these questions. Are they doctors, nurses? What's your parameters?
So the call screeners are just people in the community. Many of those are medical assistants or medical receptionists who are now seeing much less work. Aviva especially has given us lots of those. And then in addition, we're having nurses and doctors, some of whom are people who themselves are on quarantine. So we have a couple of docs who are sick and they're on quarantine awaiting test results. They're not allowed to go back to work, but they can do this by the phone. And so by the phone, they're taking calls and they can really empathize with the patients. So these people out there coughing and hacking can certainly empathize with the patients who are similarly coughing and hacking.
You've had this going now for a while. Any idea of other counties or other groups are doing similar type hotlines?
So there are some hotlines that have been put together by insurance companies. There have been some together by public health, but generally they are not community-based, and they're also not answering specific individual triage questions. So I think we're the first to do this in Douglas County. We're over 500 calls now, so I think we're doing a great job, and we're well-staffed. Now, if there are people who would like to help, we're always looking for call screeners. So you just give us a call at DPHN, and we'll help you with that. Or you can just call the hotline at 541-464-6550. That's 541-464-6550, and tell them you'd like to volunteer.
So if somebody calls with a question, then do they talk to a screener and then a second person? Is that how it works?
So first, they're all in the same. They're all sort of connected. So they would talk to a screener first, and if this is a general question like, "Do mosquitoes carry COVID?" The answer is no. Can I get a package from China? Yes. So those things they'll answer. But if it's a more specific question about the patient, they'll get some patient information and then transfer that to a nurse or a doctor, where they'll go through a series of fairly standardized questions about what's going on. The big thing we worry about with people with COVID is not the cough and not the fever, because neither the cough nor the fever will get you. But it's when people get short of breath, especially, that we worry, because we know that shortness of breath in COVID is sometimes a sign of worsening.
Now, let's talk about these Facebook Live events you've done a few of, and you're doing another one in just over an hour.
We're going to do another one tonight. So these Facebook Live events have been fairly amazing. You know, I'm an old man. I didn't think I would ever do Facebook, but these are great because people write in questions, and we take any question that comes out. We typically get more questions than I can answer in an hour, but we just do them. What we're trying to do is get people factual information. We're trying not to spin it one way or another. There are a lot of things I don't know the answer to, like when will this be over. I'll try and give my best opinion, but certainly there are some things that I don't really know the answer to, like when will this peak. That's a question that I don't think we know, other than not today.
So what's the process work? Do they just go to the Douglas Public Health Network Facebook page and watch, essentially, and then if they've got a question, put it in like you would a comment?
Yep, that's exactly right. And Kristen and Vanessa, who are here, are my comment screeners. And they do the comments, write them on a little card, and then I pick them up and read the card and give you the answer.
Wow. So you're doing this, this is kind of like, in a medical sort of way, almost like a reality TV situation. I mean, this is not, you don't have a fancy set, you don't have the bells and whistles, you're just looking at a camera and giving information.
Yeah, looking at a cell phone in a little studio and getting this done. Yeah, unfortunately, this whole last month has seemed way too much like a reality TV show.
Yeah, but probably not in a way that you would like.
Certainly not.
So other things people ought to know. We've got a couple minutes left here to wrap up just about this situation. What's your feeling about the average person in the county? I mean, you're fielding probably anybody that sees you anywhere out in public wants to run up and ask you a question themselves. Do you think we're handling it pretty well?
I think actually the state and the county are handling it about as best as you can. The degree of cooperation in the county is great. So we had a long meeting this morning about PPE. Everybody very willing to share, you know, this great effort to go ahead and make handmade masks. I mean, my goodness, what that means. The overwhelming support that we've gotten for the hotline, oh my goodness. And I got back today and there was a flower arrangement on my desk from somebody who was just happy with what we're doing. So the amount of support is great. I think the state also has done a good job. I know Governor Brown's stay home, stay healthy message will always create a little bit of rancor, but I think it is very, very, very well done. It looks at activities by their risk level and by their importance level and really works to reduce the risk. Now, some areas have gone to a total lockdown, and I think a total lockdown is very hard. Some areas have done nothing. I think that's not enough. I think what we've done in this state, the balance we've hit in this state, is nearly perfect.
And I know for a lot of people, if you go out on the weekend, and of course in Douglas County, typically there are music events or music at, you know, our brew pubs, wineries, different places. You go to a church, you go to the country club, whatever. And a lot of people probably don't think about how many people they interact with in a typical encounter like that.
So think about it. Think of if you had a 3-foot stick, how many people you could touch in a day. And I thought really carefully about that yesterday. And I wasn't a hermit yesterday. I went to work, but there was nobody else there. I went to the grocery store to pick up stuff for dinner, but I was sure that I sort of stayed away from people. When I waited in line, I waited 6 feet back from the person in front of me. When I did my groceries, they could bag them while I stood 6 feet away. And then when she put the bag there, I waited until she moved back and I could grab it. So I had very few social contacts yesterday. So if I was sick, which I don't think I am, I would have spread it to no one. And if they were sick, I wouldn't have gotten it. So I decreased my exposures tremendously, and I encourage everybody else to do the same.
Dr. Bob Dannenhofer, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me again.
This is Talking Health on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
The preceding program was paid for by CHI Mercy Health Mercy Medical Center.
The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brooks Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.